Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. You're a busy man. You got your alerts going. Notifications are going off right when you're about to start recording the pod.
I know. I feel like I'm insulting you with that. I silenced it.
That's okay. We all know you're in demand.
all good. The week feels, you know, I'm going to regret saying this because it's so interesting. Like, I will feel on top of things, and then 24 hours later, I feel like I'm drowning. It's really interesting. I don't know how it's changing that fast.
You've mentioned that before, and I feel like I've had the longest first 2 days of a week ever. I'm sure everybody who is in some kind of practice, whether surgical or therapy, knows that when you're out, you tend to pay for it right before you leave and pay for it right when you get back, unless you're very kind to yourself and play defense against it. And this, you know, coming back, this wasn't my first week back, but I got slammed in clinic yesterday. And it was just a lot of people and a lot of people with like really cool and interesting stuff that I totally dug. I enjoyed the process of seeing them. But, you know, obviously it makes for slightly longer visits and more of a stack of dictations to do at the end of the day. So I came home wiped yesterday. And then I had an OR day today, and it was a 2-room day, and things were humming along. I was actually ahead of schedule. I was congratulating myself for being ahead of schedule to the point where I was like, oh, we should call some people in early.
Oh,
yeah. But I've learned, here's what I've learned. Okay. I've learned about 6 months ago that I cannot be in charge of the schedule, like last minute adjustments to the schedule. Cause not only do I exaggerate in my mind how good I am at getting things kind of perfectly threading the needle like you do, I don't like disturbing patients on the day of surgery with changing something about their arrival, because it's already a stressful thing to have surgery and to have to arrive at a certain time and etc. So I told myself that I would not make those decisions, and I would have whoever was the charge nurse in the OR that day make the decisions. So whenever anybody's like, do you want me to call them in early? I'm like, no, I've learned not to make that decision. You need to go ask so-and-so. So I had them go ask so-and-so, and she said, no, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. Like, if they arrive right when they're supposed to. They did, but then they got delayed at registration by 30 minutes. And it just, the whole thing fell apart, Chuck. Oh. On a 2-room day, I had an hour between my cases. And I was just like, no matter what I do, I'm going to end at the same time, even though I was really efficient.
I haven't had that experience where just that.
Because you're better than I am.
No, I have the same issues. Like, occasionally you get enough ahead, or a case cancels or whatever, and you're like, should I call them in? And I, like you, try to stay out of it and just let them call patients in. My problem is if they do call someone in early and disrupt their day, like you said, it's a stressful day. They may have stuff going on before the case, but then if we're slow or we're not ready when we're supposed to be ready, it adds a layer of stress to me, because I really prioritize in clinic and in the OR being on time. And that's not a, it's about my perception of other people's sensitivities. But it's just important to me. It's really important to me. And it makes me stressed when I can't accomplish that goal.
Yeah. And I think that people that are in private practice are going to scoff at this, because clearly in big systems and academics, we don't really have the nimbleness that smaller places do. But we still, for patients who are having general anesthesia or any kind of anesthesia aside from local, they arrive hour and a half to 2 hours before their surgery time. And because we were following that even for locals, but because we had so many people that were like, why am I here just waiting for nothing, not even seeing an anesthesiologist or getting an IV or whatever, we changed our local arrival time to 1 hour beforehand, which usually is more than enough, but it still bites me sometimes, because I like to just kind of have things ready and teed up and knock it all out and get done early if possible. But that is not always in line with the patient experience agenda.
No, that's right. It is a lot to balance and figure out. And I'm sorry, your day went to hell.
You know what? It was fine. I got a lot of stuff done. I mean, you know, I've tried to just embrace the found time, and it's not like I ran over. I actually probably looks like my utilization was great today. I hope they don't dock me for the hour where I wasn't doing a case, but it happens. So, I mean, that's the trials and tribulations of being in practice.
That's exactly right. So any cool cases or clinical quandaries?
Well, I often wonder, what is your worst experience that you can remember and talk about removing hardware?
We've said on this show, and everyone knows the old adage, no one looks good taking out hardware. And I certainly have had my share of challenging experiences. The one I can remember most is taking out a volar distal radius plate in an elderly frail woman. And I was taking it out for a very specific reason. I don't recall what it was, whether it was a tendon issue or whatever. And it was not a plate I had put in. And several of the screws were stripped. And sometimes I get impatient and I did what I could. I had all the right equipment there and was still failing, and ended up taking an osteotome, and you're using an osteotome to try to break, you know, the screws off flush. And that was going okay until I levered. And there was a kind of fracture of the volar cortex. Now, the dorsal cortex remained intact. It wasn't that big a deal. But, you know, dealing with bony overgrowth, dealing with stripped screws, and dealing with, again, a precise schedule can put the heat on you.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had a case that on the list recently that I thought was going to be a bear to remove the hardware. So I overbooked the case.
And I didn't have the, better that.
I didn't have the wherewithal to put it absolutely at the end of the day for whatever reason. So then I ended up with a bunch of extra time, but I was just worried because it was a plate that, again, I had not put in. Screws were fractured. It's not my favorite material. It's titanium, which I know is more, you know, prone to stripping screw heads. But it all came out really nicely, but I was just mad at myself for not getting the booking time right. But again, like you said, it could be so much worse. Do you ever endeavor to take out screw shafts that are stuck in bone after you've already taken out the fractured head?
I have no problem leaving in. There's two issues. One, you have to let the patient know, obviously, and they need to be aware if they get an MRI or something like that. And two, some of them have what I would consider a reaction that is magnified compared to what it should be. And they just really dislike the concept of having that broken screw in their bone. And there's nothing you can do about it. And I tend to try to explain, I could have gotten it out, but I would have destroyed your bone in doing so. But that's happened to me on more than one occasion, for sure.
Do you, are you a believer in the anecdote that some surgeons say that everybody feels better when the plate's out?
No. I don't think so. Obviously, I'm biased because I only take the plates out if there's a reason to. You know, when I was in training, Chris, many, many decades ago, you know, in pediatrics, we were taking out plates just as a matter of course. You put a plate in, you take a plate out. And maybe early on in our metals, we needed to do that. But we don't, to my knowledge, in 2022. And there is never a plan to take a plate out unless it is required based on positioning and concern of, you know, complications. Is that your approach?
Yeah, it's my approach. I mean, you know, I worked with a trauma surgeon in residency that, you know, I think one of the things they would do is like start the second room of the day with an elective hardware removal just to kind of allow clearances, you know, patients get cleared and stuff for traumas. And I don't know how loose or tight the indications were to remove the hardware, but we were taking out a lot of hardware. That was the chief's room. it was not always fun, but you got it done. So,
yeah, there's lots of reasons to take out hardware, I guess. Oh Lord!
Well, but there's some countries in which it's routine to put a plate in, take a plate out, like you're saying. So. I think it's different. I'd love to hear from listeners around the world, you know, what their thoughts are about whether you take a plate out, if you automatically take one out, if you put it in, because everybody's a little bit different.
Yeah, totally agree. And you're exactly right. Distal radius plates are a great example of sometimes they automatically come out to decrease the risk of complications. I get that. Awesome. Well, do you like this? Should I send you my hardware removals?
You know what? I'm okay. You know, I'm good on my current frequency of hardware removal, although I am a team player. And if you want to send me those, I will send you all of the sportsy, vague, ulnar-sided wrist pain that I don't particularly enjoy taking care of. So we got a deal.
One plate, two ulnar nerves. We'll figure out a good referral system.
So we had an interesting recent episode with Jen Barna from Doc Working. Always nice to talk to a fellow podcaster. And if you're a podcaster listening and you want to talk with us about, you know, potentially, you know, collaborating and stuff, please feel free to reach out. You know, she's doing some really important work with her partners. But I wanted to see if maybe you could bring this a little closer to home in terms of understanding this concept of coaching, because, you know, I remember I was at, I was lecturing at the Clinician Scientist Development Program for the ORIF, and a fellow panelist who is now a chair at a program in California mentioned to me, you know, why don't you have a coach? I was like, well, I don't know. Like, she's like, don't you want to get better? I was like, yeah, I do. But I was, it's just so not part of the normal, like you mentioned in the episode, it's not part of the normal track. And it's a concept that feels a little foreign to most practicing surgeons. Some of it's persona of how you become a surgeon for most people. Others, it's like, well, why would I take the time to do this? Why would I pay for somebody? Why would I have my department pay for somebody? Like, what's the point?
Yeah. So I think it's a really interesting question. And Jen and Doc Working is really offering a really interesting service. I mean, the podcast, I think, is their way of sharing some of their work, but also promoting the opportunity to work with them for coaching. Here's how I think about coaching, and I'd love to briefly talk about burnout as well, and obviously the two issues are linked. It used to be, first of all, that coaches were just not something you talked about, because if you had a coach, it was not for a good reason. And I think today, in a very simplistic way, coaching falls into two categories. One is coaching because of a demonstrated need to improve, whatever that means, whether it's interpersonal, whether it's, you know, causing disruptions in the operating room, not, you know, just whatever the challenge is, a coach could hopefully help you get through it. And that's the one that might still carry a stigma, but I would argue it really doesn't in 2022, because coaching is also, as you just said, just to make you better. And so, as I said in the previous podcast, there is a requirement for department chairs to have coaches at Washington University, and many, many others have coaches as well. I've considered a coach, and I am fortunate. I say this very seriously, not tongue in cheek. My wife is trained as a therapist, and, you know, is great to talk to and helps me talk through things. But it's not always perfect to use your spouse in this role. So I think there's so much benefit, and I think about a coach to help me talk through career path opportunities. What do I really want? But when you've considered coaching, what would be the most important priorities for you if you were to work with a coach?
I think that if you were to ask me a couple of years ago, it would be the same kind of, you know, career planning, career trajectory, at least talking through what you think you want and confirming that that truly is compatible with your, you know, your value compass. I think that, to be very honest with you, since taking on the role of fellowship director, I don't know, about 18 months ago, I've learned that one of the things I need to work on is interpersonal. You know, and I see that all the time now that I'm focused more on it, how I interact with others, how I perceive their reactions, how they're really reacting, and trying to understand, you know, how I can be a more effective communicator and leader. And you know, taking over the fellowship role, to be honest with you, a little bit earlier than I had thought I would have wanted to, kind of thrust that upon me. And it's something I'm trying to actively work on. And I think that's something I probably would want to work on with a coach, you know, on top of the kind of the career trajectory stuff that that you mentioned.
Yeah, look, I mean, anyone who says they can't be better and do better is deceiving themselves. But not everyone, you know, has a pressing need for a coach. But I think someone who is honest with you about things, and someone you can bounce ideas off of, and someone who can pull, you know, information out of you. I just think it's really important. And there should be no stigma. I mean, there just shouldn't be.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like there are probably some people that were getting what you should get from a coach, other ways. You know, I remember early on, I think the first 4 or 5 years of my practice, I met monthly with either, Richard Gelbman or Ken Yamaguchi. And that, some of that, yes, was largely research focused in terms of mentoring for a career development award. But there were times where it was mainly about, you know, Dr. Gelberman telling me specifically what nobody else would tell me. I remember him saying that he was going to be my mirror, for better or worse. And he told me stuff that I think I needed to hear. Now, whether you're going to get that same kind of candor from a lot of people in this day and age is different. But I think that, that at that point in my career was an important thing for me to have. And I think that that's something that I would probably will want to have now. I guess I the question you asked, you know, in the last episode was, you know, what kind of background does this person need to have to truly be a great coach? I mean, because I honestly think somebody like Dr. Gelberman would be a really good coach for the right person in the right mindset, because of his just deep familiarity with or the context of academic medicine.
Yeah, it's a good point. And what I've hesitated on is I guess I need sort of a sounding board or someone who can push me to be honest with myself about things. And also understand landscape. That's my concern.
Right.
And I think that coaches are obviously, every coach is different, brings different backgrounds. And so I think that it would unlikely to be the first coach I would talk to that I would choose. But you're right. Someone like Dr. Gelberman could be a good coach. I don't think it would be a multidimensional, coach, but certainly in one or two domains could be really effective.
So now we're going from having a coach to having a staff of coaches. You know, you've got the GM, you've got the offensive coordinator.
Exactly.
Special teams.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about, I mean, other ways to improve ourselves. I mean, if someone had the time to spend with me in the OR and critique how I teach and how I operate and what I can be more efficient in, there's no doubt that would be valuable. There is zero doubt that I could learn from that. But our system in the United States is just not set up that way.
Yeah, I remember reading a New Yorker article. I don't remember the specifics, but I remember reading it in residency. Atul Gawande wrote about himself having a technical coach in the OR. And I think about that all the time. I actually almost ended up embarking on a research project with one of our former residents on the technical aspects of coaching, because I think it'd be fascinating. And please, somebody take this idea, because it's not mine. But to, you know, watch tape of residents operating and fellows operating and surgeons, you know, attending surgeons operating, and just go through the tape. We have the technology now. It's not that much, you know, that difficult to get. Because I know even there are studies in the general surgery literature in which you'd send in your laparoscopic cholecystectomy video. And as part of board certification, you know, you would get judged for efficiency, for safety. I think that'd be great, because as somebody who I personally am always trying to hone my craft and the skill that comes with it, I think it'd be fantastic. I hope that I would be good at receiving the feedback, although I sometimes maybe I wouldn't be. But you know, I think that's part of it. And I think that the technical aspects of coaching and the coaching about teaching, you know, because that's one thing that I still constantly have to work on is meeting the learner where they are, because you know, we see such a variety of trainees, you know, not only junior resident, senior resident, fellow, but then also medical students. You know, how do you make sure that they have the experience that's appropriate for their level, and not only their level, but their personality? Because you know, they're not going to change. We're the variable that needs to change to meet them.
Yeah. And I agree with everything you said. As you were talking, I was thinking about our therapy colleagues. And you know, a lot of times the setup, and I can really only speak to the setups that I've seen, obviously, are conducive to interactions and perhaps collaboration. You know, the way our therapists work is there's multiple therapists in a room working with different patients. And I know they get up and interact with one another. And I wonder maybe if their culture might be more conducive to, not necessarily coaching as we're talking about it, but at least support and discussion and optimization of their technical process, perhaps better than us.
Agree. And you know, we talked in that episode about things that bring us, that fulfill us at work. And, you know, you talked about, you know, collaborating with Lindley Wall at the Shriners. And I know you guys do clinic together and you operate together. And, you know, when David Bergen and I do complex nerve clinic together, when it works out, I love watching him examine somebody or counseling somebody together, and just kind of learning from each other and being collegial in that way. And Yeah, that's the best system to work in, I think, especially for somebody as something as complex as what you see at the Shriners and what perhaps what we're doing in the nerve clinic.
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. I think we should, I want to talk a little bit more about what you and I do to combat burnout. I don't want to beat a dead horse here. We talked a little about it at the last, but it feels like we should come up with at least seven ways we fight burnout. Is that, I think we can get way more than seven, but what do you think?
We can try. I mean, you know, it's at this point in my life with the podcast and all the other various venues and my, I guess, becoming more comfortable with self, I feel like I'm an open book. There are a lot of things that people know about me on the podcast that that they probably wouldn't or shouldn't in other contexts. You know, and this is no secret for me. I think starting the day, if possible, with exercise is important to me. That fulfills me, and you know, I wake up early to do it. It's the only time I truly get to myself, which is important. And I remember trying to do the working out at the end of the day thing, and once you know the kids came, that was impossible because I would try to go to the gym at the end of clinic or at the end of the OR, and I would feel guilty I wasn't spending time with my kids. You know, so that's one thing for me that that is important. So everybody's going to have their own routine and how they do it, when they do it, how frequently they do it, what they do. But you know, some kind of physical activity that you know gives you the time you need for yourself and the endorphins and the actual health benefits too.
So I totally agree, and I second that. My story is interesting, at least to me. It used to be basketball, and I had some early games and I had some weekend games. And what I loved about basketball, and I know I've talked about this, is when you play basketball, you can't think of anything other than basketball. When you jog or bike, sometimes your mind wanders back to work, which is counterproductive. I'm not playing ball anymore because I'm old, but what I am doing is I'm riding my bike to work. It's about 5 miles. And I have to say, and it's early, I'm riding in the dark most days and I come home. It's fantastic. And 5 miles, you know, you could argue, God, it's not very far, and it's not, but it's far enough. I get a little, you know, heavy breathing, and then coming home, it's more uphill, which is convenient because I sweat more, and I love it. I really love it. So that's filling that same void for me.
What are you going to do in the winter? Still do it?
Well, last year, when it gets ridiculously cold, no. But it's pretty flexible. I'll do it down into the high 30s. Low 40s. And the heat never bothered me. So as hot as it want, you know, it can be, but yeah, if it gets too cold, I'm not doing it. No way.
And then what about the Chesterfield days or the, I mean, so the Shrine you can do, but the Chesterfield days, probably not.
I can do 3 days a week if the, you know, and then like Thursday I have a 6 a.m. meeting. So that requires an earlier start than normal, getting on the bike a little earlier than I would probably prefer, but I think I'm still going to do it.
And when you travel for meetings or travel for fun, are you still wake up, you know, do something in the morning, guy, or you kind of let that routine slide?
The routine slides. I find a way to work out, but not in that typical routine. It may be, you know, doing, whether it's walking on the beach or finding another time to bike or run or something. Yeah, the get up early to exercise is not required. Why? Do you still have to get up early to exercise?
I do, because I'm a night, as one of my favorite instructors says, we're nicer people after we exercise. And I truly am. So it's almost like coffee to me. They kind of go hand in hand. But so yeah, I tend to still get up early because then I know it's done and I'm not worried about it because inevitably I will worry about it. That's just my personality.
So what does cooking do for you?
I have found so much joy in that. It's not only it's the process of cooking. It's more of the sharing. And it's however I think it makes me feel about, you know, taking care of friends and family. Like, for example, like weekends, that's kind of the bigger deal of like, you know, okay, we can like actually get together and let's do something bigger. And I enjoy the process of like in the kitchen, planning everything out. And, you know, it's all stressful at times, but, you know, it's fun. And, you know, the having everybody enjoy it, if it's good, is even all the better. For some reason, I'm really fanatical about the weekly menu planning. We haven't gone the route that some families do of like completely prepping everything out at the beginning of the week. I love on the weekend, I actually look forward to this, of sitting down and making a menu and making a plan, like looking at like, okay, here's what's going on these nights of the week. I can do this. Tiff is doing that. You know, the kids have this going on. And I was like, let's come up with something that's going to work. And whether it's something simple or a little less simple, the weeknight stuff tends to be pretty straightforward, but I still like that. And it makes me feel better. At least I think that my kids see the process of like something being made, and that, you know, whatever they are eating is not just out of, you know, automatically gets, you know, appears out of nowhere. And I'm not judging those that do that, because I think that that's a reality in a lot of ways. But I personally find joy in that process of being able to thread the needle of getting home, making something that is reasonably healthy and delicious, and enjoying it together.
Yeah, I hear you, and I realize how important it is to you. I have to say, I'm starting to understand it a little bit, in the sense that there are times when I partake, and but food is just different for me. And so it'll never be my priority. I guess I would say replacement, or, you know, something important to me is reading. I read every day, not as much as I would like. I usually am reading multiple different books. I tend at the end of the day to read some type of either historically based fiction or just stupid fiction. It just puts me in a good place. On the weekends, I try to read nonfiction where my brain may tolerate it. My dad used to say, when I was growing up, I used to ask why he didn't read serious books. And he goes, well, you know, my job is serious, and I don't, you know, I need to escape, not dive deep. And I get that. I totally right. get that.
I wish I could read more. My problem is that, you're gonna laugh, but like, as soon as I start to read something, I usually fall asleep. So,
but that's fine. That's fine. I do too sometimes.
I don't want to say it's chronic fatigue, but, you know, I know that I know my body, I know my energy levels. As soon as, you know, something, as soon as I start to do something where I'm completely sedentary and the room gets darker, I know what's going to happen. I've managed to learn kind of how much sleep I need, you know, how much sleep is ideal, how much sleep is tolerable. And just the sleeping is something that, you know, to the point where there was a moment where I had multiple books on my bedside table. And Tiff would just tell me, which one of your sleepy books are you going to read tonight? She knows.
Yep.
So yeah. No, I wish I could read more though. I think that's super important. So I think that'd be great if, you know, anybody wants to share how they have addressed, you know, their strategies for, I don't want to say just for burnout, addressing burnout. I want to say fulfillment, because, you know, making sure that you're, you are getting the most out of, you know, what you want to, you know, to see on a daily basis. And I think that probably there are some things that we could talk about in a future episode about just strategies to make your life more, either more efficient, or more pleasurable at work.
Yeah, I think we should talk. We've touched on those topics, certainly. But I think it's always worth revisiting, because, you know, we're evolving, obviously, and what I said 2 years ago might not be what I say today. And I love the topic. Efficiency is something I take pride in, and but can always be better. So this was fun. I think we're both evolving in this area and how we consider coaching. We certainly consider burnout and really pertinent topic. And in August of 2022, I guess this will drop in September of 2022, but it'll still be pertinent.
Well, we'll see who has a coach in a year.
That's exactly right. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good evening.
You too.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.